A very stubborn man today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Zimbabwe's military gave President Robert Mugabe until noon today to resign. He did not.
President Mugabe is known to be a very stubborn man who believes firmly that he is the correct person to lead Zimbabwe. I mean, he's praised himself over the years.
But after almost four decades in power, support for Mugabe in Zimbabwe has all but evaporated.
He has had 37 years in power. He shouldn't even be there for another 37 seconds.
Plus how American hip-hop is fueling a dance craze in Rio underneath a highway overpass.
Every Saturday night around 11 p.m., this empty space fills up with hundreds of people. There's a hip-hop DJ, there's strobe lights, and they dance until at least 4 or 5 in the morning.
That's all coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Monday. Robert Mugabe just doesn't seem to get the message. His long party in Zimbabwe is over, even after an apparent military coup against him and widespread calls for him to step down. Mugabe seems determined to stay put. He's 93 years old. He's been in power for 37 years, and the country's military had given him a deadline of noon today to resign. Instead, Mugabe simply announced his cabinet would meet tomorrow as usual. Meanwhile, his own party, known as ZANU-PF, dumped him as its leader over the weekend, and today the party announced that impeachment proceedings against the president would begin tomorrow. Senior ZANU-PF official Paul Mangwana said it could be over in as little as 2 days.
We are expecting the motion to be moved tomorrow, the committee to be set up tomorrow, and hopefully by Wednesday, we should be able to vote in parliament. The main charge is that he has allowed his wife to usurp constitutional power when she has no right to run government, that he has refused to implement the constitution of Zimbabwe. Thirdly, he is of advanced age, that he no longer has the fiscal capacity to run government.
The push for a fast impeachment vote has a lot of support. Human rights lawyer Beatrice Mtetwa has often faced the anger of Mugabe's government, and she says impeachment is the best way forward.
Since everybody agrees from all the political divides that he should go, they can short-circuit the process by ensuring that parliamentary rules are suspended for purposes of ensuring that the process is fast-tracked. Parliament has the power to regulate its own rules, so they can actually fast-track it if they wish to fast-track it. And from all accounts, they do want it over and done with by yesterday.
Even staunch supporters of Mugabe are piling on. Zimbabwe's War Veterans Organization, which shares Mugabe's legacy from the War of Independence, now says he should go ASAP.
To the international community, we say we want all the pressure to be brought to bear upon Mugabe so that he vacates office. He has had 37 years in power. He shouldn't even be there for another 37 seconds.
Bottom line, a stunning turn of events for Robert Mugabe, a man who has come to embody the role of the classic African strongman ruler. It is a familiar profile, a former leader of an independent struggle who held onto power by short-circuiting democracy and human rights, and who grew wealthy in the process. Africa has been slowly shifting away from this strongman model, but as we've been hearing, Mugabe is not ready to give up his power. The BBC's Phumzi Philani is in Johannesburg, South Africa.
It's not a secret that President Mugabe is known to be a very stubborn man. He is known to be a man who believes firmly that he is the correct person to lead Zimbabwe. I mean, he's praised himself over the years for having been able to defy the U.S. And he really prides himself in having been able to, quote, withstand the power of the West. So he then sees everything that's happening now currently as sort of a lesser fight. So he still rightly feels that he is the man for the job, and that when he does step down, it will be when he feels that the time is right. We understand that he's made no secret that if it comes to sort of a negotiated exit, he at the very least would want to leave after the elections come 2018 next year, which for a lot of people feels like a long time.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of Mugabe's cross to bear, though. I mean, if you look around Africa, the strongman narrative seems to have kind of dissolved after the Cold War. Am I wrong?
It certainly has. I mean, we've seen uprisings in recent years. I mean, most of Africa's liberation has come through some sort of blood, but most of it has been through opposition parties or opposition gatherings, whether it's a rebel group that's come together and then has become legitimized as a government. But in this special case, I think, with President Robert Mugabe that we're seeing, which is slightly different from the coup attempts that we've had in the past, is that the ructions are coming within his own party. These are people that have been loyal to him for years, people that he's been in the trenches with, people that he had brought Zimbabwe through independence with. They are the ones that are now saying, enough is enough. You are no longer good for the future of Zimbabwe. You are, in fact, divisive, and we need you to go, and we need you to go today, which is different. And I think that, on a personal level for him, has been a very difficult adjustment to make, because these are people that have saluted him and have been enamored with him for decades that are suddenly saying, hang on, this isn't working for us, and we need to change gear. And that's the bit that's making him reluctant at the moment. But he still fancies himself a very strong man.
So if strongman implies either dictatorship or elections that are not free and fair, what countries would you point to in Africa that offer kind of a competing narrative, where elections do happen, where power transfers peacefully and poverty has given way to some kind of sustainable prosperity?
I think one of the countries that come to mind, not even so far from South Africa, is Botswana. Botswana has a long-standing history of smooth transitions from one president to the next, from kind of a sense that when elections and democracy happens, that it is successful, that we've seen that with kind of strong economic policies and a strong sense of democracy, that those specific countries are able to thrive. We had an Ian Khama presidency that some people were worried about because it was passed down from his father, and some people thought it might be kind of the beginnings of a dynasty and wanting to run the country as a family business. But the policies that were in place and sort of the smooth transition after each election gave people a sense that there is enough stability in the democratic process in Botswana that regardless of who's at the helm, the country will still hold. And that is something that a number of African leaders haven't been able to get right. If you look in Burundi, for example, in 2015, where President Pierre Nkurunziza found himself in the middle of a coup and an uprising, and people were trying to get him out of the country. But it seems to be a message, though, that isn't quite translating well to African leaders, the sense that there needs to be a time to leave office. And we've seen with South Africa, for example, South Africa is having sort of a milder version of the questions that are being raised about who should lead the country and whether the strong man is still relevant.
Do you think that over the years, a lot of Africans, many different countries, have accepted this strongman narrative, and therefore it's kind of become a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts?
I think so. I think it's one of the things that have not been questioned enough about the history of Africa's political landscape. It's one of the things that have kind of held, that have been accepted because of the historic role that a lot of these leaders have played. And also, if you'll remember that Africa is an incredibly patriarchal society, so it's almost second nature for certain things to not be questioned here. But I think what's happened over the years, though, is with sort of the rise of things like social media here and access to mediums that make it easy for young people to express their unhappiness with their leaders, it's also created a generation, especially with the younger people, it's created a space where they are essentially holding truth to power. They're holding the people that have led these countries over the years without much question. They're trying to hold them accountable. And they're doing it through social media. They're doing it through organic protests. They're doing it through protests on the streets, questioning, you know, things that maybe their parents would not want or demand answers for. And that's the difficulty that these strong figures are finding, in that now they're having to be accountable to somebody. And also they're having to be accountable to somebody that's younger, which isn't something that always goes down easy here.
My colleague Phumzile Philani with the BBC in Johannesburg, thank you very much for your thoughts and for the context for this. Appreciate it.
Most welcome.
So as Phumzile mentioned, South Africa is another country whose leader might be looking over his shoulder now. The president there is Jacob Zuma, and one reason he's under especially intense pressure at the moment is a new book called The President's Keepers. It's by investigative journalist Jacques Pauw, and in South Africa it's become a bestseller almost overnight. The book has been described as dynamite that will shake the foundations of the halls of power in South Africa, and apparently it already has. The country's state security agency tried to have the book recalled, but instead sales spiked, and bootleg PDFs of the book began to circulate online. Kim Clute is a journalist based in Cape Town, so we know President Zuma has been implicated in several corruption scandals in the past, so the revelations here aren't exactly a new thing. What are the key points in Powell's new book that have turned this thing into a runaway bestseller?
Yes, well, there's certainly been explosive allegations, as you've said. First of all, I think that Jacob Zuma didn't pay tax for the first years of his presidency. He was incredibly reckless with money, and he was always bailed out. But not only didn't he pay tax, but he was completely protected by the coterie of people in various institutions, and particularly at the South African Revenue Services. And if anybody questioned any bribery or corruption, they were dismissed, they were taken to court, and there are all sorts of allegations about this in the book. And also, he's been tied to a sort of range of smugglers and gangsters in illicit business dealings, and sort of very importantly, cigarette smuggling too. So he's benefited from illicit proceeds, and he received a salary of about $80,000 a month from one of the benefactors. And then also, there have been fresh allegations about his connections with a powerful Gupta family who've got an iron grip on the government.
So are all of these new allegations, or all of these revelations that nobody'd ever heard?
Well, that's been brewing for some time. And, you know, Pravin Gordhan, who was the finance minister, was removed from his post. There's been people who've been at the head of the South African Revenue Services who've been shoved aside. So they've been sort of undercurrents, but this is sort of the first time that they've been documented in such detail and exposed in this way.
As I said, the State Security Agency, or the SSA, tried unsuccessfully to have his book pulled from circulation, but now they've accused Powell of criminal activity. What are the charges?
They've accused him of violating the Intelligence Services Act, that he's actually looked into state secrets. But he says there is no way that he can be accused of that, and that it's completely in the interests of all South Africans to hear this. The publishers are saying they're absolutely going ahead. They're certainly not withdrawing the book from any shelves, and that he's prepared to speak in court. You know, he's got no problem about that. He's not fazed at all. And in fact, he says that he could reveal so much more. This is sort of almost the tip of the iceberg.
Tell us a bit about Jacques Powell. What's his reputation in South Africa?
He's got an excellent reputation, going back many years. So he was very active during the apartheid era. He exposed terror, torture, and death squads by apartheid agents. And he sort of had his life at risk with that. He's also been in Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, exposing corruption and violence there. And so he's got a very, very good track record. In the last few years, he's been working on books, burrowing away, digging out every single detail. And he got very, very high profile interviews as well.
I mean, it just sounds like any attempts to ban his book have only made people more intent on reading it. What has been reaction from the public and from politicians?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The reaction has been overwhelming. As far as politicians go, you know, they've asked for Zuma to resign. They're trying to find ways to fire him, for him to be removed. They've called for a national debate in Parliament. And also so much hinges on the ANC national conference at the end of the year. So people are perhaps waiting for December to see what will happen there. But they are really hoping that he will be removed from power then. And then also just the public, while the books have just flown off the shelves, there have been so many orders. And I think it's sort of brought this whole momentum that's been brewing over the last few years. All of these allegations that have been coming, complemented by protest marches throughout the country. And now these recent allegations are just sort of explosive. They're just hot as anything.
I mean, Zuma has survived 8 votes of no confidence in Parliament in South Africa. What is your take? Do you think this book will be the turning point for Zuma?
Well, I think it's definitely going to be the turning points in the long run. I think Zuma is going to crumble on this, but it just depends when. I don't know if it'll be December, if indeed there is a conference of the ANC, or whether he manages to push that off the agenda. There's still a very strong kind of powerful thing around him to try and protect Jacob Zuma, but he's certainly losing followers by the day. I think his time is running out.
Journalist Kim Clute in Cape Town, South Africa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Wind turbines versus reindeer in Norway, a 21st century dilemma that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. There was some progress in Bonn. We're talking about this year's global climate summit that wrapped up over the weekend in Germany. It was the first one since President Trump announced the U.S. will pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Reporter Emily Holden was in Bonn for Politico, and she's now back in Washington. What actually got done, Emily?
Well, we weren't expecting to see major decisions out of this meeting. There was some modest progress made on completing a rule book for exactly how countries will ratchet down their greenhouse gas emissions under the Paris Agreement. The rule book is actually due in 2018, and a lot of negotiators were saying that they might have to meet again before that conference in Poland to make sure that they get this done in time. But a lot of environmental advocates were pointing out that even if countries do reach the goals they've agreed to, that the world is still not on track to keep rising temperatures from going above 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which is what scientists are really concerned about.
Now, the U.S. can't technically leave the deal until 2020, and I gather there was a lot of talk about whether the U.S. under Trump would be an obstructionist force in Bonn. That did not turn out to be the case, apparently. What role did the U.S. play?
Right. So this was one of the first really big testing points for how the U.S. is going to be engaging with other countries on climate issues. And you did see White House aides have a very vocal panel discussion about how they wanted to promote fossil fuel use in developing countries, which was met with pretty fierce protest. But at the same time, you had negotiators from the State Department really working with diplomats from other countries, much in the same way that they did under previous administrations, including the Obama administration.
That's interesting. So as the U.S. kind of tries to walk these two paths, China is positioning itself as the new global leader on climate change. And I know a lot of people were watching these talks to see if China would live up to its rhetoric. What did you see? What did you hear?
Well, we saw a push by China to actually allow middle-income countries to have different standards, easier standards for how they report on their emission reductions. And that will be probably discussed again next year, too. I think that some people felt that China was really trying to exert its power, working with other developing nations to push some of its goals, but not necessarily taking on the same kind of role that you'd seen from the U.S. in pushing countries to set tougher goals and work together on those details.
So did it feel like in Bonn that China was kind of replacing the United States?
I don't think so. I do think that any time that a country has an opportunity to push for something that it wants in this negotiation process, if it thinks that there is a gap in leadership or influence, that you're going to see that happen.
That's Politico's Emily Holden, just back in Washington from Bonn, Germany. Thanks a lot, Emily.
Thank you.
The rights of indigenous communities got some attention at the Bonn climate talks. Delegates agreed that from now on, indigenous people will also have a seat at the table as countries work on ways to tackle the climate crisis. It's a crucial addition because indigenous communities in many parts of the globe are already being hit hard by climate change, and some are also being hurt by efforts to fight it. We have a story from our Livable Planet desk today on one such community. It comes from reporter Amy Martin.
This is Ruksusvarri, the Red Mountain. Yeah, and then you have a new mountain. It's called Vilkisvarri.
Reolf Alexandersen is standing on top of a windy mountain on the coast of Norway, about 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. He's talking about the Sami names for this place and others nearby.
They had a lot of small names, small canyons, small rivers, and knowing the names are really necessary and really a big part of the living style.
The Sami are the indigenous people of northern Scandinavia and western Russia. They've lived off the land here for millennia, fishing, hunting, and in many families, herding reindeer. I met Reolf, his wife Ristin, and their three children last June on a long reporting trip around the Arctic. The family is trying to maintain Sami traditions, including grazing their reindeer here on this mountain. Today, they're building a fence to gather and mark their calves.
Wow, a lot of work.
Work, yes. The reindeer herding is working. You're not getting fat.
These days, part of that work is adapting to climate change. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and in northern Norway, that often means rain instead of snow. That's bad news for the reindeer. They can forage through snow, but not ice. So the Alexandersens now have to do a lot more work to feed their animals in the winter. But climate change isn't their only problem. The family is also threatened by a climate change solution, wind power. As I was visiting them, a 280-megawatt wind farm was being planned, 67 new turbines slated for this very mountain. Sara Katrina, age 16, is concerned about global warming, but she questions why her family and her reindeer have to bear so much of the cost of fighting it.
What is better, many reindeers or hundreds of wind turbines?
And it could come down to that. Research suggests that reindeer don't like wind turbines. Even the sight of them seems to scare the animals away. And there will be a lot of turbines here.
It's among the largest European onshore projects.
This is Stefan Klepsland. His company, KR Wind, helps set up financing for the new project. Norway's demand for renewable power is growing, and Klepsland says wind can help meet that.
In Norway, you have a lot of excellent onshore wind sites. There's a huge potential for further development.
But the question is, where will those developments be? Like reindeer, many people don't want to live next to wind turbines either. Even with the growing consensus that we need to transition to renewable energy, local communities often oppose big wind farms. And that doesn't sit well with reindeer herder Risten Turi Alexanderson.
We will all need to sacrifice something if we are to save this planet.
We spoke via Skype after I got home.
And people are not willing to do that. So they just push it forward to the people whose voice will not reach so far away.
And those people are often members of indigenous groups, says Catherine Wessendorf of the International Working Group for Indigenous Affairs. She says indigenous people are often the most impacted by climate change, but citing these kinds of projects on their lands can hurt them too.
It's not that indigenous peoples are against renewable energy.
But Wessendorf says developers of renewable energy projects often repeat the mistakes of the fossil fuel industry, leaving indigenous people out of the planning process or ignoring their rights to their lands. And she says green energy advocates often have a blind spot on the issue.
When I sit together with conservation groups, environmental groups, when I start talking about rights, everyone gets a little bit annoyed.
A Norwegian government official told me that several of the country's wind farms are located close to cities. And he said that this new project went through a full environmental review. Risten Turi Alexandersen says her family could have lived with the wind farm as it was originally designed. But she says the developers changed that plan at the last minute, adding a road that runs right through their prime grazing area. They're appealing the change, but the road is already being built, and she worries that the noise and traffic may cause her family's reindeer to scatter into the high mountains, where they could starve this winter.
Once you start, like, with dynamite, then you could scare the reindeers, and we wouldn't know where they go.
That would be a big blow to the family, especially high schooler Sara Katrina. All of her hopes for the future revolve around the reindeer.
I think that everything we do with the reindeer herding life is special and have a meaning. That is something I want to take care of.
For the world, I'm Amy Martin.
Amy Martin hosts the podcast Threshold, and we had support for the story from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Actress G.K. Bose has roots in many different places, including Polynesia. Hollywood didn't know how to cast her on screen, but as a voiceover artist?
I could be whatever. I could be a pony. I could be a princess. I could be a dragon. I could be, you know, somebody who wasn't me.
Her story still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Germany has been a perennial symbol of political stability, but after coalition talks broke down late yesterday between Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative bloc and their potential partners, it looks now like that reputation for stability could be taking a hit. Melissa Eddy is the Berlin correspondent for The New York Times. Let's start with last night's events, Melissa. Leaders of the Free Democratic Party, the FDP, they walked out of the negotiation room that effectively ended talks of a three-way coalition government. Why was that? Like, what issues they say they could not agree on?
So they ended talks abruptly shortly before midnight, and these were just the preliminary talks before they would head into the real coalition talks. And the sticking points have been climate change, finance, and the big one has been migration and refugees. However, interestingly enough, the FDP, the Free Democrats, did not name any of those points. They simply said they felt that there were too many unresolved issues in the agreement that they were working on. And secondly, they said they felt that there was a lack of mutual trust amongst the parties. And they called it quits based on that.
So I mean, we're talking parliamentary democracy here, let's remember. Can you give us kind of like the Cliff Notes version of the horse trading that Merkel had to take on after the election?
So Merkel's party emerged as the strongest force, meaning she was tapped to try and form a coalition. The second and obvious choice for her to partner with would be the Social Democrats, but they refused to go into government with her. So she had to turn to two smaller parties who disagree on a number of issues and try to bring those two smaller parties together in a government with her own conservatives. And it was an incredibly difficult process over 4 weeks that ultimately last night failed.
So it's complicated with all these different parties and with all these different issues.
It's extremely complicated, yes.
But the bottom line is Angela Merkel leading a majority government. Is that just out of the question at this point?
At this time and point when we are having this conversation, it is currently out of the question. Now, what happens after these talks have collapsed is that it falls to the German president to figure out what he is going to do next. He appeared before the public today, and he really put the pressure on the political parties, saying, you were elected to get a government in order, so you need to do this before we're going to do anything else.
So if the president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, decides that Germany should hold snap elections, what might come out of that vote? Could it be counterproductive for Merkel?
Well, it's interesting because the German constitution deliberately makes it difficult to call snap elections. But if he should get to that point, interestingly enough, Chancellor Merkel said today she actually would prefer snap elections to what would be the main other alternative, which is she runs a minority agreement.
Government that basically disempowers her, right?
That's correct. So she said she prefers the snap elections. Now, a lot of people have been saying up until now that they fear the snap elections could strengthen the far-right AfD, Alternative for Germany party. They are crucial because they came into parliament for the first time, and they came in as the third strongest force. And they took a lot of votes away from Merkel's party, weakening her and getting her here in the first place.
There was some concern about the strength of Merkel as a candidate going into the recent election, but she did kind of seem unassailable. Are these developments all suggesting that it might be the beginning of the end for Angela Merkel?
On the one hand, it looks that way because she's weakened. On the other hand, she is still popular amongst Germans. Recent poll, she came out as the second most popular politician, only behind her former finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, who has been in office for a very long time and is a very senior, respected member of her party.
Yeah, so given all that popularity, how are Germans reacting to these developments?
This morning it was really interesting to see because as an American over here, the morning after Trump was elected, there was complete hysteria on social media and on the television morning shows. And this morning it almost seemed as if they needed time to digest the fact that their own country is now faced with a politically new situation that they haven't seen before. Mm. And they're frustrated. They don't want to have to vote again. They think it's going to be a waste of money. And they have been saying, these people were elected. They are our lawmakers. Their job is to govern. They should get on with it.
Beyond Germany, what does political instability for Merkel mean for the rest of the EU?
Well, it could be really tough because right now you've got Emmanuel Macron of France, who would like to see the EU move closer together in many aspects. You have the British government that with Brexit is trying to extricate itself from the EU. You have this complicated divorce process going on with London. And then you have on the eastern flank Poland and Hungary, which have very nationalist populist governments that are pushing now away from the EU. So what is really needed is a strong force and a figure who can bring everyone together. And for the past decade, more or less, that person has been Merkel. And her absence would certainly leave a vacuum.
That's Melissa Eddy, Berlin correspondent with The New York Times. Okay, if you've been alive in the U.S. for the last 25 years, you've no doubt at least caught a glimpse of Apu. He's the owner of a convenience store on The Simpsons. And recently you may have heard of The Problem with Apu. It's a new documentary by comedian Hari Kondabolu, who, like many South Asians who have watched and enjoyed The Simpsons, was upset by this character. It's not just that Apu is a stereotype of South Asians, it's also that he's voiced by a white guy. We'll hear from Hari Kondabolu later this week on The World. But of course, it's not just about Apu. There's a broader conversation going on about so-called whitewashing in the world of voice acting, white actors playing non-white characters. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, though, the industry's changing, and one actress in particular is feeling the impact.
Moana, the main character of Disney's movie, Moana, grows up on a Polynesian island, surrounded by people who accept and include her.
You are the next great chief of our people.
And you'll do wondrous things, my little minnow.
Oh, yes, but first, you must learn where you're meant to be.
G.K. Bose had pretty much the opposite experience growing up in the tiny town of Weed in Northern California.
Everyone had their place and knew who they were, except for me.
Bose has roots in lots of places, including in the Polynesian region. People take her for a lot of ethnicities. And when she was a kid, that meant she didn't fit in anywhere.
Every day I prayed to God before I went to bed that I would wake up with blonde hair and blue eyes, that he would make me white. Because I thought, if God must not like me because I'm brown and because I'm treated so poorly by everybody.
She felt like she found another version of that in Hollywood when Bose was trying to become an actor. She says casting directors wanted her to fit into just one category.
I tried it. I tried identifying as an African-American woman for a while when I first started acting. Awful. I felt like such a fraud.
Voice acting seemed different. Bose saw a white woman voicing the character of a young black boy, and at first she thought that was weird. But then Bose realized that also gave her permission to be whatever she wanted to be.
I could be whatever. I could be a unicorn. I could be a pony. I could be a princess. I could be a dragon.
Or she could be Barbie. And for years, Bose was the official voice of Barbie.
Getting to do blonde hair, blue-eyed Barbie, I was like, oh, maybe this is God's little way of answering that prayer. You know, all these years later.
But lately, things seem to be changing. Bose says casting directors seem to care now about finding voice actors of the same ethnicity as the characters they're playing.
You know, I recently auditioned for, you know, a character that's African-American. And they even called my agent and they said, is GK African-American? Because we really liked her for this character, but we really want to cast an African-American for this character. We know she's Polynesian, but can she, you know, authentically say? And I was just like, ugh, why can't she be Polynesian?
That, though, is just one anecdote.
I think anecdotes are humorous. But I like to refer to that in this phrase that I often use, which is called adventures in missing the point. When you focus on anecdotes, you miss the real reality.
Stacey Smith and her team do a yearly analysis of representation in the top 100 films. They're at the University of California, Annenberg. And Smith says, overall, Hollywood's progress has been minuscule. One example, of the top 100 films last year, 34 had a female lead or co-lead. Just 3 of the women who played those leads were from underrepresented groups.
I wish it was a different, you know, a different pattern based on our data, but our data present a fairly condemning picture of the lack of motivation and follow-through of this very progressive Hollywood community.
Their numbers show in 2010, of the animated films that made the top 100 movies, 1.5% of characters came from underrepresented groups. In 2016, that shot to nearly 49%, but only because of 2 films focused on underrepresented groups. One was Moana.
My name is Osnat Schurer, and I am a producer at Walt Disney Animation Studios, most recently of the movie Moana.
Schur says across the board for all its films, Disney's trying harder to find voice actors who can authentically represent the characters they're playing.
We're making movies for the whole world, and it's not that easy, actually, to convey in the right way the essence of a character.
For Moana, they decided they also wanted someone who was authentically near their main character's age. So G.K. Bose was out of luck. And they needed someone who could sing. All that made finding the right person tough.
Oh boy, did we ever get lucky.
They put out a worldwide casting call, listened to hundreds of auditions, and still didn't find her. Then the casting director in Hawaii remembered someone she'd heard while helping a local nonprofit find people to sing a jingle.
She just remembered this young woman. There was something about her.
That was Ali Cravalho, a Hawaiian high schooler. She came in for an audition.
See the line where the sky meets the sea. It calls me.
I have to tell you, it was so moving. First of all, she was amazingly good. And then when I took a photograph with her after the audition and she was near our already designed Moana character, she looks like her.
That maybe sounds more like the on-screen world that G.K. Bowes gladly left behind. But there was a happy ending for her, too. Bowes still got to play Moana, just in the audiobook version.
Unaware of what a close call that had been, and already over the trauma of being in the water, Pua happily nuzzled her face.
The job got her on the cover of Polynesian People magazine, and Bowes finally had proof she belonged somewhere and that some group claimed her.
You know, so I kind of was like, look, I told you I wasn't black. Like, I told you I wasn't, like, you know, straight up Latina. I told you I wasn't Cuban. I told you I wasn't, you know, Puerto Rican. Look, I'm Polynesian. It says right here, Polynesian People magazine. That's me.
So does Bowes think casting directors should find voice actors who authentically represent the characters they play or not? I asked her that, and she says she has no idea. For The World, Rupa Shenoy.
Rupa is with me now to talk a bit more about this, because I read something on our own site, PRI.org, about this last week. Ada Singh wrote about how actors of color have traditionally and overwhelmingly been relegated to one-dimensional roles as bad guys. Did you meet any actors who talked about that?
I did. I spent time with a guy named Kelvin Han Yi, who actually played the police chief on Hawaii 5-0.
So now that the case is closed and your record's clear, HPD would like to reinstate you at the rank of lieutenant.
I truly appreciate the offer, sir. But we're doing great work over at 5-0. That's my home now.
Hawaii 5-0 made headlines a few months ago when two of its Asian stars left, right?
Yeah, those were Korean-Americans Daniel Dae Kim and Grace Park. They said they weren't getting paid as much as the white actors. And since then, they've been replaced, actually.
Wow.
Yi says, in a weird way, what happened there actually shows progress, because at least now there are Asian-American stars who are big enough that they can say no to a part, because most Asian-American actors still don't have that ability. They're scrounging for jobs. Yi says he agreed to play bad guys for years because at least in those roles, he doesn't help fuel the stereotype of Asian-American men as emasculated.
The bad guys are at least masculine, and many, many Asian male characters that you see in scripts are demasculated in some way. And I turned those roles down, limiting my employability and my casting and my insurance.
Wow, so many sonic layers we don't hear behind those voices. Really incredible.
Yeah, and what I found really interesting about Yi is that there's a personal toll behind him trying to change these stereotypes, because he wanted people to see Chinese Americans like himself as just normal Americans, and he gave up a lot to accomplish that.
I broke my parents' heart. I broke their heart. I have guilt about it. I believe I put him in the grave.
Wow, it sounds like he's bearing a burden.
He is, definitely. Because he still asks himself if all of his whole career was worth it.
What I continue to notice, especially as an older Asian actor, is that when I audition for things, I am almost never called upon to play my own experience. I am called upon to play the other.
So, Rupa, what is Yi doing now?
He's been cast in the HBO sci-fi drama Westworld. Have you seen it?
I have not. I saw the original movie with Yul Brynner back in the 70s. I need to come up for air for this one.
I actually think you'd really like it. He plays a guy who lays train tracks in the American West, and that's actually something one of his granddads did in real life.
Mm.
But he says this character has real depth.
Well, comparatively, this is progress for Yi. Rupa, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Rupa Shenoy of The World's Otherhood podcast. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. Rio de Janeiro is a dancing city. Dancing on the beach, dancing in clubs, dancing in the streets, during carnival, not during carnival. There's now a new dance venue you might want to add to your itinerary if you're heading to Rio. It's a bridge, or actually a spot under a bridge, where cariocas who've embraced and adapted a form of American hip-hop go to dance. Reporter Catherine Osborne has written about this style. It's called Baile Charme. Catherine often joins us on the show, and she's with us now to fill us in on the scene. So I hear you've been hanging out beneath the overpasses of Rio lately, Catherine.
Yes. So the dance I wrote about in a piece for America's Quarterly is called the Baile of the Viaduto de Madureira. And Madureira is a neighborhood on the city's northern outskirts. And the Baile do Viaduto is the dance beneath the highway overpass. Every Saturday night around 11 p.m., this empty space fills up with hundreds of people. There's a hip-hop DJ, there's strobe lights, and they dance until at least 4 or 5 in the morning.
It sounds like the early days of hip-hop in the South Bronx. They find an empty, vacant lot, and they go to work.
Right, exactly. And it was inspired by that. And it's just sort of a surreal scene because it's underneath one highway, but really this spaghetti bowl of intercrossing highways, and there's buses going by on either side, and they get lit up by the strobe lights too. And people come from all across the city to dance here. It's a real scene.
So what do the moves look like? Like, how derivative is it really of hip-hop? Can you see hip-hop in it?
You can. Charme is the Brazilian version of what in the U.S. is called soul line dancing or urban line dancing. And it's a dance where everybody faces the same direction and does moves in unison, kind of like the electric slide.
Yeah.
And the name in Brazil was coined by a DJ in the early 80s who, during the age of disco, wanted to slow down the pace a little bit in his sets. And he would play every once in a while slower R&B music, and he would say, it's time for the hour of the charm, Charme. Mm-hmm.
Chegou a hora do charminho, transa o seu corpo bem devagarinho.
Brazilian choreographers eventually would look at hip-hop and R&B dance moves from music videos in the United States and sort of create their own spins on those. And often the Brazilian version is way faster and looser, and both your hips and your feet are just going crazy sometimes. Some of the routines are quite complicated, but others are more simple, so you can kind of show up and just look and see what everybody else is doing in front of you and follow along.
So who comes out for these dances under the overpasses?
What's amazing about the dance under the overpass is that it's teenagers to people in their 60s. And additionally, there are several other Charme dances that occur in other parts of Rio, in plazas and empty streets in the city's downtown. And often they'll be like the first Saturday of the month or a certain time per month. And some of those have different crowds that frequent them, like folks who have been at this since the 80s. Some have more teenagers. And there's even a huge Christian Charme dance.
So baile simply means dance. Baile Charme, not to be confused with baile funk. Baile funk absorbed a lot of violent favela culture, and some of those dances themselves actually got pretty aggressive. Is baile Charme getting attention as an antidote of sorts to the kind of aggro feel of baile funk?
Yeah, that's a good question. So funk music is more popular in the city's favelas, and often the MCs will be from favelas. And because that is a very strong association, local authorities, specifically the police, have a history of repressing funk dances. Sometimes the dances do get aggressive, sometimes not, but there's a big stigma against funk music specifically because it's sort of the music of folks from these poor neighborhoods. What's interesting about Baile Charme is that the sort of scene and the aesthetic is a bit different. The choreographer Marcos Azevedo calls it the dance of the black citizen. So of black Brazilians who have arrived at full citizenship and are proud to express themselves. And they take a lot of care in the fashion going to these dances. There's four pillars of Charme culture, according to the dancers: music, dance, fashion, and treating people with respect. So the vibe on the dance floor is very positive, very affirming. The fashion looks like you walked into Brooklyn in like 1992. There's a lot of jean jackets, high tops, shoes and haircuts, neon afros, that kind of thing.
So are the cops giving the Baile Charme parties a pass when they're making noise and doing the strobe lights like at 5 in the morning?
They are, and interestingly, some scholars have written about this, that like, you know, if folks are well-behaved and dress within a certain aesthetic, they're allowed to express feelings and values of black pride. Also, the lyrics are in English at the Baile Charme, and the lyrics are in Portuguese in baile funk. And so when you say, like, you know, I don't like the way the police treats me in Portuguese, the authorities respond in a different way.
I mean, it's interesting the way you describe Baila Sharmi suggests kind of a class distinction with, like, Baila Funk.
A lot of this is about performance, right? Because the people who go to these dances, Baila Funks and Baila Sharmis, tend to be from similar socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm. Usually you have to pay around 10 reais, which is like $3, to go into a Baila Sharmi. So that's a bit of a difference as opposed to just sort of rolling up. And usually you would have to take a bus to get there as opposed to a dance that's already happening in your neighborhood. So you could say that, yes, there's a bit of a class difference, but a lot of folks leave the Baila Sharmi at 5 a.m. and then they go to a Baila Funk afterwards, which goes until sunrise.
Catherine, did you pick up a few moves while you were reporting the story? How are your Baila Sharmi skills right now?
They're better than they were a couple of years ago, but I still should probably stay at the back.
Okay, let's pretend you and I are both at the back of the crowd, walking through a couple of moves.
There's some basic back and forth moves. There's a dance called the Brooklyn Dance, which is where you kind of stand on the balls of your feet and swivel your knees in and out.
I got it.
That's one.
I'm doing it now.
You can also do, everybody, of course, can, like, you know, jump to the left and then do everything to the left facing that direction. You can do the shuffle, brushing your foot back and forth, like kicking lightly on the ground. And
yeah, got that.
Uh-huh.
What am I supposed to do with my hands?
Just have them be loose. Americans like to dance with the tops of their bodies. They put their hands in the air.
I know.
And they wave them around.
We got to remember to shake our booty.
Yeah, Brazilians care more about what's going on the lower half. And so just kind of let your hands, like, swing down by your side. Focus on stepping and the shaking on the lower half, and you'll be totally set.
I want to be Rosie Perez, but I'm feeling more like Julia Stiles and Save the Last Dance. But that's okay. Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio, thanks so much for your time and for the lesson.
Thank you, Marco.
That's Music Soul Child, M-U-S-I-Q, just one of the artists whose tracks you might hear if you make it to that spot under the overpass on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, just a stone's throw from the Mass Pike overpass, I'm Marco Werman. Join us online at PRI.org, and we're back here on the radio with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.